Okay, so I am here with Dennis Cooper, who is most recently the author of The Marbled Swarm. Dennis, how are you doing?
I'm good.
First off, let's start with cannibalism. I think that's a very good place to start. I mean, this is not exactly a subject in which one can find first-hand material in quite easily. So I'm wondering, sort of using this as a jumping point to talk about the overall violence in your work, you know, how do you get that precision of biting into things?
Well, you know, I mean, the internet, imagination. I did some research into it. I did a lot of research into it.
Such as?
Oh, you know, just, you know, there's a lot of people that do it, you know. And actually, there's not only people who do it, but there's these fetish sites where people, like, you know, advertise themselves as be interested in all sorts of things. And one of the fetishes is cannibalism. And I don't think anybody ever does it, because otherwise there'd be arrests all the time. But they're very detailed about their fetishes and about the ones who want to eat and the ones who want to be eaten. It's not a huge subculture, but it is there. And you know, so I got that. And, you know, there have been guys throughout history who've done it. So
yeah.
And then ultimately in the book, you know, there really isn't that much. He just talks about it all the time. So
it's a good sort of litmus test as to whether one should carry on further. So you looked at sort of underground websites. You looked at...
underground.
Your IP must have been tracked when you were performing these
searches.
Well,
they're not that underground. They're just like, yeah, they're for like, you know, there's like, it's there's this site called Recon. It's just like, you know, basically it's essentially a master and slave site.
Yeah.
But there, and which is what it is, but there's all kinds of subtext. There's people who like, I mean, there's weirder things than that.
Yeah.
There's these guys that want to get wormed.
Oh.
That's the thing, is they want to be wormed. It means having their arms and legs cut off and live like as a worm on for their masters. So,
yeah.
I mean, there's stuff that's weirder than cannibalism.
Wow. Worming. They actually do get wormed.
Well, I don't think anybody ever should do. I think it's all...
Yeah, sort of a BDSM onto the next level.
But they're very serious about it. So, yeah, so I mean, and those are all totally above board sites. So.
Above board.
Yeah.
The Marbled Swarm in this book, it's described as an industriously garbled syntax, a quote-unquote appears quite a lot in the book, exalted style of speaking that the protagonist learns from his father, and that becomes, in his tongue, more of an atonal fussy bleat. So, you have this protagonist who is constantly alluding to hints of a deeper story throughout the text, but he's also using language as an excuse for his behavior, his fantasies, and whatnot. He claims at one point, "My father used the marbled swarm to, well, I was going to say become a wealthy man, but to say he ruined my life would be as accurate." So, the interesting thing about that is that the implication is that language, especially this sort of, you know, stylized language, is really almost comparable to moral justification for why you had a shitty upbringing and the like. So I'm curious about this, especially with most of the paragraphs beginning with still, comma. There's almost a comic formality about this reconciliation. So I'm wondering how this patois developed, and to what degree is this a response to, I suppose, reconciling confusion?
Well, yeah, I mean, my books are kind of, in some fundamental way, always about reconciling confusion, because that's super interesting to me. And, you know, language, you know, presents this, you know, idea that language, that confusion can be, you know, corralled and all that stuff. And, you know, it can't, and that tension there's interest me. But how this happened, I don't know, it was just, it took me a long time. I'm really slow, and I do all these experiments, you know. I test out things and try different forms and things, And it was a combination of living in France and not speaking French very well, and it was an eerie, interesting thing to be like on the metro or whatever, and hearing people talk and sort of understanding a little bit what they're saying, but not completely, and having to sort of make it up or something, and imagining, because people always say that I romanticize French people enormously because I'm a huge Francophile, and that, you know, so when I'm on the subway with these people and I imagine them being, you know, talking like Rimbaud or something, and of course they're talking about their laundry or whatever, and so that began to interest me, that I do that, and so that started me the idea of trying to create that in fiction. And also I usually had written very in a spare way, but I wanted to really make it really dense, and so it would really multitask, because I like things to be really layered and experimental. And so I tried to find this voice that was really, really, really dense and could do a whole bunch of stuff at once, and just fiddled around until that one came up. And then I had to figure out like what was, because it's really limited in what it can do. I mean, its tone is very particular and it's really irritating. And so then it was just a matter of, how fast should the pace be? Because do people not get too sick of this guy?
And
like, can't, how he can be kind of funny, but he can't be really like sincere, but only in a certain way.
Yeah. Did you actually end up speaking like this character during the course of writing it? I mean, it's certainly, I'm listening to you now and you don't sound anything like that.
No, I have to do readings of this now and it sounds so awful.
Oh, yeah.
I have to read
those. I mean, did you read any of it aloud to make sure that you it sort of could be plausible or anything like that?
No, no it all worked in my head like that.
Well, you mentioned this voice being irritating and slowing things down. I'm wondering, you know, your books do have a tendency to irritate some people, especially the mainstream. So how much irritation is enough in your fiction?
It has to be really balanced out because, I mean, it has to be... I always feel like I have to do something formally or stylistically or structurally, something to justify that stuff, you know, because I'm not interested in, you know, people think, you know, there's this idea that, like, not just me, but other writers that do stuff like me are like out to shock and all this. And it's just so not true. It's completely the opposite. It's like how can you use really like aggressive language like that and not be shocking? That's my interest, you know, because it's such amazing language and it's very emotional. It's very pure. And it's like, if you take that away, if you start doing, you know, treating it like a horror movie, or if you start doing psychoanalytical kind of thing about what the motivations behind that kind of stuff, you really lose the power. So I wrote that power and I want to try to tame it or something. So I don't know. It's always tricky with this book. I mean, there's not as much violence in it.
Yeah.
And the language really, like, so when you get to the part there's one part that's really kind of intense.
Yeah.
And I think I'm hoping that like the language is so you're so involved in kind of the language and it's sort of pleasurable or think it's funny or something that's kind of the barrier.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you mentioned taming the language. Can your type of language ever be entirely tamed? Especially this moment that we're alluding to about, I think, 120 pages into the book, which, you know, I found parts of that both funny and vaguely horrifying, but the funny, to my mind, outweighed the horrifying.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm just warped.
Well, yeah. I mean, no. You can only do so much. And it's like, and I try different strategies at different times in different books and things, and this one, it's like you get used to how he's like circumventing everything and subverting everything and doing. He uses metaphor all the time.
Yeah.
So that when he gets to the sexy, the metaphors are. It's really totally metaphoric. It's like this, and you know when something violent happens, he'll say like it, and he'll reference like an alligator or something.
Sure.
So that's just my strategy, and you know, I mean, I it isn't going to prevent people from being shocked, but with this book, I feel like you have to really be looking for it because it's like. It's not as aggressive as it in my other books. So.
Yeah, that's true. I'm wondering if you look to any specific types of people to get the marbled swarm of this book or the garbled marbled swarm. I mean, did you listen to a specific type of, I suppose, affluent wanker or what?
It's a little bit just to kind of like the sound of French literature or certain kinds of French literature. I mean, you know, there's a little bit of that, like Alain Robbe-Grillet and Sade and some of the writers that were important to me. And then my own voice. I mean, it's like basically me, disguising my voice. So a lot of it's just my usual stuff. I mean, the sentences are much more complicated than my usual sentences, but it's all basically my voice. It was just more like trying to keep it, you know, trying to keep it sounding foreign and maybe kind of French, but also like having all this weird American stuff thrown into it. And so it was kind of like a garbage language. And I mean, the thing that it sounds British, and that's the thing I was trying not to make it sound, but people think it sounds British. And that was, I couldn't really get around that because people, and especially in the States, when you speak English and you're very articulate, you basically are English.
Yeah. So. I don't know. To my mind, it sounded like some kid who had grown up listening to a lot of European phrasing in his household. And this is the result.
Yeah. But. Yeah. Yeah. That's ideal.
We were talking about shock value earlier, and I'm wondering if confusion to a certain degree is the new shock value, the new recursive loop. I mean, some of the HTML giant crowd who have been lapping up your book constantly talk about having to reread it and reread it and reread it, and I must confess that I was tempted to reread it and reread it and reread it, but I also had other books to read, no offense. I like your book. But,
yeah, no, that's
but that is interesting to me that because this is a book that suggests an explanation, but that actually doesn't necessarily offer one. And I'm wondering if this is really the new way to confuzzle people, so to speak.
I don't know. I don't know. It's always been something I've been interested in, but I was able to really, really like work specifically with confusion. And like, because it is, it's you know, if you want to get into the book, it's very organized and you can actually solve it. you know. But you would have to be like a particular kind of like a train spotter kind of guy to do that.
Yeah.
But it's logical, but it makes no sense. I don't know. I find that kind of stuff really wonderful. I like art that does that. I like things that are kind of bewildering. You know. I mean, you get obvious examples, and you know, in a funny way, I mean, Occupy Wall Street is all about confusion too. It's like that's what's interesting about it, right? Is that it's like it's amorphous. Like, what the fuck is? Do they want? It's so huge and confusing.
Yeah.
So there's a power there, certainly.
So confusion really is the 21st century mode of existence these days, and fiction needs to actually reflect that.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's fun, too.
Well, what of all the revealing secret rooms, the expanded space within cars, the stories expanding from stories, the distinguishing the tight jeans CGI from the more honest ass secreted in their shadow? Cannibalism, of course, human carcasses that are concealed within living humans. I mean, to what degree are some of these representations red herrings, or are they all part of this mystery that one person reading your book 12, 15, 16 times can figure out?
Yeah, you know, I hesitate to go there. Because I sort of decided I wasn't going to give too much away. I mean, you know, what the guy says in the book is the truth.
Yeah.
That's what I'll say.
Well,
if he says something, because he changes things all the time, and he says, like, I'm telling you the truth now. And when he says he's telling you the truth, he's telling you the truth.
Yeah. Well, sort of in a similar vein, do you think that present narrative needs to have more longers and more asides along these lines in order to have this truth that we speak of? Or?
Gosh, I don't know. I mean, I like that kind of work.
Yeah.
But it's the minority. But I like some of these newer, younger writers who are coming up are doing that. I mean, certainly Blake Butler and people like that are working with that. I love that stuff. So that's my interest. But I don't know if that's going to be the interest of larger people. I mean, larger audience. I mean, you know, there's only so many. You know, I mean, as much as like some of us may love, you know, Lynch or Into the Void or something.
Yeah.
It's a, you know what I mean. There's not. It's still a pretty small audience for that kind of work, so I don't know.
Yeah. Do you have to have a comical mode in order for it to be... I mean, Enter the Void, I think, is also an inherently funny movie.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. As is Lynch, really.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it really helps. I mean, it leavens the thing, and it's like a sedative. It work. You can use humor like a... Humor's like a drug, and you can regulate it. It's really... It's like a, you know, you're on a drip or something when you're reading something. If you can use humor, it can really help you a lot. Certainly with my work, I use it all the time, because, I mean, it really helps with slipping in violent things and things that are really disturbing and throwing people off. It's a great device.
Do you laugh at your own violence?
No.
No?
No. I mean, the violence is very, you know, I mean, I'm disturbed by it and haunted by that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
No, it's just about trying to figure out how to communicate exactly what I'm thinking. And the humor sometimes seems to help simulate the state, even though I don't feel funny about it.
Oh, is it often funnier after the fact, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, you know. Yeah, but I mean, my first drafts are really, like, raw. I don't write this kind of... I didn't write that, like, one draft.
Yeah, sure.
So originally the horror is more there, and then I fool around with regulating it.
Why did it take so long to write? I mean, obviously there's a concern for getting the patois right, and obviously there's a concern for getting the voice right.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It seems to me that you're more of a deliberator rather than a sort of gusher as a writer.
Or? Yeah, I don't... Yeah, my first drafts are just shit, and I don't have a natural writing voice. I have rhythms and certain things, but I don't have a natural voice, and I always have to construct, in every single of my books, I have to construct the voice. So it's always a labor-intensive thing for me. And with this one, I mean, this is, like, not my voice, and he had to be clever all the time, and it was much, much longer when I wrote it, and, you know, because I'm not clever all the time, and sometimes you're inspired when you're writing this voice, because I knew how to write the voice, and I could do it really a long time, but, I mean, you know, there'd only be, like, once or two, three times every page where I'd get something, I'm like, okay, that's clever, and so I'd have to cut everything out and then compact it. So it was just you could probably see how difficult it was.
Yeah.
And to figure out everything, the system's working, because there's all these things that are connecting inside it and everything, and it was just, you know.
How much of this massive puzzle did you have in place?
Before?
Yeah, before.
I had the structure in place, and I had the idea of, like, how I wanted the secret tunnels to connect, and how I wanted there to be, like, all these connections, like there's these characters, Flatzos.
Yes.
And then they connect with this, with the anime thing, and they connect with the three bears and the book thing. There's all these things that I create systems. That's what I do.
Yeah.
And then, but then the story, actually, I let myself improvise with the story, because it had to enliven it. Otherwise, it would have just been a stupid exercise. So the actual secrets and everything are there, but where they end up being and how they end up being represented, like in images and stuff, that comes in a more kind of improvisational way. And then I have to fiddle with it and fuss with it afterwards.
Did you watch anime? Did you go to anime conventions? Do you have hostility towards those who are into anime?
No, I really like anime, and I did. It's not called Die Color Die.
Yeah.
But there is a big Japan Expo there, and that's all real. But I'm really interested in anime. You know, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
What of like keeping up with the Joneses, so to speak, when you're dwelling upon youth culture like this? You know, technology itself has to remain current. Is this a issue with you? I noticed not just the anime, but a couple of references to types of internet things, smartphones, and all that. How much do you obsess over this, or do you just do it?
Do you mean just technological advances and stuff?
Yeah, technological advances, making sure that you're speaking that patois that youth is and all that.
I don't. It's not about youth. I'm weird because I'm just interested. I'm still interested in really new things. But the internet is like a huge. Yeah, I mean, I wrote this book called The Sluts, and it's like it's based on the internet. It takes place on the internet, and it's based on how the internet works. And that stuff. I mean, I'm always looking for because I don't really like fiction so much. I mean, I like certain writers, but I don't really care about novels or normal kinds of novels. They don't interest me. So I'm always looking to other places to find out ways to make a novel without them becoming like conventional. So, and the internet is like, then video games and music and all these other things. And the internet is obviously, it's like moving so fast, and it's got these exciting structural moves inside of it. So I pay a huge amount of attention. I do this blog, so I'm on the internet constantly.
I've seen it. The protagonist here is unnamed. Is it possible that he is a sort of representation of George Miles, or did George Miles ever factor in not on this one?
No. Well, he says his name is a magical group of words that can be. He has a name. He just doesn't tell you what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. In his book forum review, Joshua Cohen pointed out that this book's withholding of a clear-cut skeleton key for the text suggests that turning literary tricks a la Paris emigres, Joyce Beckett, or Henry Miller has become its own species of deviancy that, like all recent deviancy, has become rather tired and flaccid. He then went on to suggest that your attempt to write a novel, it was almost an act of auto-cannibalism. I'm curious about this, if you can respond to some of this. Is transgressive fiction still possible in this age where just about every shocking thing has been said? Is the age of literary tricks largely over? What of this?
No, I don't agree with that review at all. I respect Joshua Cohen, but he just completely misunderstood the book to me. But I don't feel that way. I don't feel that the avant-garde and the transgression are exhausted, and language is exhausted. And the book has nothing to do with that. I completely believe in all those things. So yeah, no. I mean, look. I mean, there's representations of it constantly. There's new. It's constantly. That doesn't really make any sense to me. I mean, there's as much transgression in film and music and everything right now as there's ever been, and it's just as alive and just as vital, and it attracts people just as strongly as it did whenever.
But do you think, like, for example, Beckett, Joyce, and company can still be deviant today? Or what is deviancy in fiction these days?
It depends on when you read them, obviously. I mean, you can read you can see anything at 13 years old and think it's great. I mean, there's millions of 13-year-olds who go see, Lars von Trier movies and think they're, like, profound.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm not a big fan.
The last one, Melancholia?
I'm not a fan of that guy's work. But it's like, if I was 13 years old, I'd think, holy fucking hell, I've just seen God, you know? So, it depends on when you read it. It depends on how sophisticated you are. Sure, I mean, by the time I read Beckett, that stuff had been out for a long time. It had been homogenized in the culture, and same with Burroughs and stuff. It was still very vital to me. And in like even my early books, like I don't even think about it, but these kids will find them and say like, oh my God, I could hardly sleep, and it made me feel sick in the stomach, and I'm like, really? So I think it stays there. It's just how much experience you got around it,
Yeah.
I think books, people don't read. The thing is that people don't read books that much anymore. It's becoming this really specialized thing. So I think actually books do hold a lot of power because people don't read fiction, and so they'll pick up a book of fiction that's like an experimental book of fiction and read it, and it's just because it's words doing that to them, it can be very powerful.
Yeah. I know that you started Little Caesar as a way to connect the punk and the literary scenes, and I found a Volume 1 Brooklyn interview you did in which it was pointed out that the haughty exclusivity, which applies to literary culture, runs in sharp contrast to punk. I'm wondering if literary culture in 2011 involves like so many people who are carving out their little niches, all trying to compete against each other. Can it be said to be truly punk these days? I mean, we were talking about books as a marginalized medium. Is there a literary culture that can today do something what you did back with Little Caesar? Or?
I don't think it's punk anymore. I don't know that punk and the internet work together. I don't know. Maybe they do. I just haven't quite figured out how that could work. But no, I mean, I think what's happening with HTML Giant and with and that kind of scene around there, and you know, the kind of groups like the Taolin group people, and then you got like, you know, the you know, Publishing Genius and all those press. There's so many amazing micropresses, and I've never read better work by young writers in my life than I am right now. So I think that's the equivalent. The interesting thing is that it's mixed in with, because the internet, it's like the MFA kids have access to that stuff too. And so I'm like, what is this? Because like HTML Giant is on the one hand extremely, very radical, and it's like really, you know, gives you a lot of fascinating stuff. And at the same time, this audience for it is, a lot of it is like MFA students. So it's, again, it's like confusing, I guess, and I like that. But, and I guess that's the equivalent, you know, but there's just, you know, it's just this, punk isn't around anymore. It's just, it doesn't exist, you know.
It doesn't exist because there just isn't anything to revolt against these days? Because everything's just so whacked down?
No, there's always things to revolt against. It's just, I just think of, like, punk as being really analog. And I think it's, you know, and I think it has to do with guitars. And it has to do, and it's just like, it's just everything's changed, you know. And things are more subtle now. And it existed. It's just, you can't be sincere like that anymore, you know. Yeah. I don't think you can. I don't think that kind of sincerity reads like, it's like watching a silent movie now. It's too sincere.
Really?
Yeah,
it can't be reclaimed in another form, perhaps later on down the line.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, probably, but I just think it's much. You have to ignore sophistication in a way that you didn't have to back then. There wasn't as much sophistication to ignore. It still felt like this thing that was coming out of the '50s or something. And now, I mean, to be punk now is like, you know, you reject so many things that are so interesting.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Well, it's interesting that we're talking about punk while emos are also a part of this. They're the ones who are basically victimized by this protagonist. So it seems to me that this is almost, you know, I guess it's eating itself up. It's eating emo. It's eating everything. Right? Wow. So I mean, does punk matter? Does mainstream culture even matter? I mean, or is it just, are we all now so whacked down that we can't, we don't really have anything aside from our own books or to read or to write?
It's pretty compartmentalized.
Yeah,
I don't know, but the internet is like offers this incredible availability, and like, you know, I mean, I do this blog, and it's like there's people from all the world posting on there, you know, and so I mean, so there's every possibility that wouldn't exist, but it does seem like you unite around, you know, you get your kind of, you know, like I'm a cult writer all the time, and I think it's like everybody's kind of a cult writer now or a cult artist now. So, I mean, you know, I mean, so I suppose that's true. I mean, but there is, like, all these people that watch Dancing with the Stars and stuff. I mean, it's so completely foreign to everybody I know, but that's a very large group of people.
Yeah.
So, and I guess it means something to them. I guess American Idol means something to those people. But it's so foreign. I don't know. So it's hard to say. I guess I'm too much on the outside now to know.
Well, you're on the inside. Harper Perennial has published this book. What's the difference between this and, say, you know, previous presses you've worked with?
Oh, they've been great. I love being with Grove Press and stuff. But I mean, they're great. They've been great. I mean, Harper Perennial is like a weird little thing inside of HarperCollins. You know, I mean, they do some really interesting writers, and it feels like an indie press to me when you're there. You know, it does. So, I mean, that may not be true, but it has that vibe about it. It's very personable and stuff. So, no, they're great. I'm like the luckiest guy in the world for a writer like me at this point in my career.
Yeah.
To end up a place like this. I mean, writers like me, like, you know, they end up with small presses that, you know, for the rest of their lives. So.
But a lot of the people who are in Harper Perennial, I mean, they published Blake Butler.
Sure.
They published Justin Taylor. A lot of the HTML Giant approved authors end up at Harper Perennial. You are spoken of very highly at HTML Giant as well. So do you think that now we're seeing this progressive stuff really kind of work in the inside here, that now we're dealing with outsiders who are actually insiders?
It's going to be interesting. That's definitely happening.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's not, you know, there's them, these people that, there's a lot of those people that you associate with them that are moving up. And Taolin just moved up.
Yeah.
And Shane Jones moved up. And Amelia Gray moved up. And it's Tony O'Neill. There's a lot of people that are moving up into that. And it's going to be really interesting to see how they handle it. I mean, the same thing happened to me. I published my first like four or five books with small presses, you know, and then you get this kind of like devoted small readership, and you get some critical attention, and then the presses go like, okay, they've got an audience, so no matter what, they're going to sell maybe a few thousand copies, and so let's take a chance.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's happening to them. But I mean, I really believe in these writers. I think this is like a renaissance, you know. I really, really, really excited about it. So I could see this really working, you know. I don't know how well Blake's and, you know, Justin's books sell, but.
But do you think, though, at some point that this outsider art becomes insider art? I mean, you know, you're
I didn't.
You didn't?
No.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I mean, I don't, you know, I'm not I'm very disliked. You know, I mean, I get a lot of nice people liking me at HTML Giant, and I get a lot of good internet stuff and a few independent stuff. But I mean, it's not like I'm a darling of the New York Times or ever going to be, you know, nominated for a book prize or anything. I mean, I'm totally considered to be like this outsider, bizarro guy who happens to be able to write.
But on the other hand, you haven't seen Tao Lin, Justin Taylor, Blake Butler receive sort of death threats from the Hooker's Undivided Liberation Army, which you did it for Frisk. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a fundamental difference between the reaction to literature from years ago what it is now. I mean,
Well, it'll be interesting to see. Who knows? I mean, Tao, you never know with Tao. I mean,
that's true.
I mean, he can do anything. You just, like, never know what he's going to do. Yeah. So he's a special case.
So you consider yourself an outsider? That you're always going to be an outsider? Does the outsider-insider even matter, these definitions? Or
depends. I mean, I kind of like it ultimately. But it's weird. It's weird when you publish a book, because then you don't think about it, and then you publish a book, and the book comes out, and the publicist is like trying to get reviews, and there's all this stuff about that, and are you going to get this, and are you going to get that? And then you realize, like, okay, you know, I'm excluded from a bunch of this stuff that, like, more mainstream writers get, and I don't really care, but you notice it. But it doesn't really bother me. I mean, I'm so used to it by now. I mean, I suppose there was a time when I was younger when I thought, okay, I'm going to make them, like, accept what I do, you know? But then you go, like, you know, these people are... most people do not want to read about this stuff. It just upsets them, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. Do you think that most of that got out of your system with the writing of the George Miles Quintet? Or?
Yeah, I feel more free after that, because, I mean, that was a project I'd planned since I was a kid, you know, really young.
And yeah.
So, yeah, I just do whatever I want now, and, I mean, I don't know, it just... I'm just lucky because I got a following, you know. I mean, most writers like don't get to have this kind of following that keeps following their work and stuff. So I've just gotten really lucky. I don't know what it is, but it's great, you know.
Yeah. But if you were starting out today, do you think you could do what you do now? Or
it'd be really hard. It would be really hard. I mean, it was a combination of things when I started out. One, there was this gay fiction trend that helped. Because they could put me as like the bad boy. They had, you know, you all had your position, right? Like David Levitt was the good boy and I was the bad boy, and you know, it was all that kind of stuff. So there was that, and also Grow Press was still Grow Press.
Yeah.
And now it's not anymore. So at that point, even though Barney Rossen wasn't running it anymore, it was still that spirit, and they were like publishing Kathy Acker and then Gary Indiana and some people who are more in that spirit, right? So I was brought in because I was part of that tradition. There's nothing like that anymore. So I wouldn't have that kind of family to go into. So I would
not imagine, like $2 Radio or something.
Oh, I'd publish with $2 Radio. Exactly. I love those guys, and that's what I would do. I'd publish with people like that if they had me.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know. My material's really tough, you know? And it's like, I managed to get around that. I managed to get around the whole gay thing like that, you know, because it's obviously that's not really an issue, which just makes me very happy. But if I were starting now, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You do this what you have right now, which is have a blog and just kind of put things out there.
I don't know if I'd want to do that if I was young.
Well, Dennis, thanks very much. It was a pleasure to chat.
Thank you, man.